Hare Krishna. Good morning, everybody. Welcome to Radhakala Chandi Srimad Bhagavatam class. Hope you had a good weekend. You can just take it right now. You sure? Are you going to go? Okay. You're welcome. Okay, so good morning. Today we're reading from the Srimad Bhagavatam 11th canto. The philosophy of Sankhya. It's a very scientific description in our scripture. And we can talk a little bit more about it after we chant. Jayarada Madhava. Hare Krishna, thanks for coming. It's nice to see you dancing. Are you a dancer? No? See, Indian women have so many arts. It's really nice. Very artistic. Jai Radha Madhava Jayakum Jabbi Hari. Madhava Jayakum Jabbi Hari. Gopi jana valabha jaya giripanada hari jaya girivada hari. Yasoda Nandana Braja Jana Ram Jana Braja Jana Ram Jana Yasoda Nandana Braja Jana Ram Jana Jaya Jamuna Tira Vana Chardi Chakum Chabihi Hare Jamuna Tira Vana Chardi Chakum Chabihi Hare Jaya Radha Madhava Jaya Kum Chabihi Hapani Radha Madhava Jaya Kum Chabihi Hapani. You're very welcome. We sing this song before the class every day. You familiar with the song? No? Which place in India are you from? Nice. Okay, well, it's really nice to have you here. My name is Narottam Das. My wife and I, we just live across the street from here. You're living here in Dallas now? Just coming to visit? Oh, really? Oh, yeah, you kind of look like her. Now I see the resemblance. Yeah, how is she doing? I see. Anyway, it's really nice to have you here. And your name? Your name? Gitika. Okay, nice to have you, Gitika. Pranams. Okay, well, we like small songs. So reading this morning from Srimad Bhagavatam, we're in the 11th canto and chapter 24. And we're beginning with text number 8 today. We have it on the board. So traditionally together we chant a mantra. It's Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. You know that one? Yeah. So we chant that 3 times and then we'll read the Sanskrit verse together. Okay? Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. So I'll read it just word by word first and then we'll chant together. It goes, Artas, you guys can repeat after me. How's that? Artas, Tan, Matrikanj, Jagne, Tamasad, Indriyani, Cha, Taijasad, Devata, Asan, Ekadasha, Cha, Vikritat, Artastan, Matrikanjagnehe, Tamasad, Indriyani, Cha, Tajasad, Devata, Asan, Ekadasha Chavaikritat Artastan Matrikanj Jagnehe Tamasad Indriyani Cha Tajasya Devata Asan Ekadasha Chavaikritat. Let me try. Atasan matrikaj jagne tamasad indriyani cha tajasad devata asan ekadasha chakvakrita Gitika? Am I singing right? Gitika? Gitika? Artastan matrikaj jagne tamasad indriyani cha tejasa devata asan ekadasha chakvakrita. Would you like to try it? Artastan matrikaj jagnehe tamasad indriyani cha tejasan vatai asan ekadasha chavakrita. Okay, excellent. All right, so word for word here. Arta, the gross elements. Tat matrikat, from the subtle sensations, which themselves are derived from false ego in the mode of goodness. Jagne became generated, tamasat, from false ego in the mode of ignorance. Indriyani, the senses, cha, and taijasat, from false ego, in the mode of passion, devata, the demigods, asan, arose, Ekadasha, 11, Cha, and Vikritat, from false ego, in the mode of goodness. Translation report by the loving disciples of His Divine Grace, Srila Prabhupada. From false ego, in the mode of ignorance, came the subtle physical perceptions from which the gross elements were generated. From false ego, in the mode of passion, came the senses. And from false ego, in the mode of goodness, arose the 11 demigods. Purport. From false ego, in the mode of ignorance, sound is generated along with the sense of hearing to receive it, and the sky as its medium. Next, the sensation of touch, air, and the sense of touch are generated, and thus, from subtle to gross, all the elements and their perceptions are generated. The senses, because they are busily engaged in activity, are generated from false ego in the mode of passion. From false ego in goodness come 11 demigods, the deities of the directions, the wind and the sun, Varuna, the Ashvini deities, Agni, Indra, Upendra, Maitra, Brahma, and Chandra. Om Gana Tamarandasya Gananjana Shalakaya Chakshusan Milyatam Jena Tasmai Shri Guruve Namaha Shri Chaitanya Manobhistam Stapitam Jena Bhutale Swayam Rupa Kadamayam Dadati Swapadantikam. So we're discussing subtle science here. Nowadays in the world, pretty much even our biggest scholars and intellectuals, even our religionists, they have no idea about the subtle nature of the soul and creation or how karma functions. You see, here the scientific explanation is being given to us because the Vedic literature is a science of consciousness. Generally, when we practice religion, it's generally based on tradition, rituals, and also our faith, that we should believe in God, we should, do the right things, you see. But without a science to support, you see, the existence of the soul and God, then we just function on the platform of sentimentalism. In other words, someone should believe in God, right? You should believe in God. Well, can I see God? How do I perceive God? You should believe in the soul. You should do the right thing. Why? Well, because you're being told to. See, generally, our modern education system rejects religion because of this point. If you look around universities here in America, it's pretty interesting to see how all of our universities were founded on teaching religion. They all have large cathedrals, large churches, the Southern Methodist University, you see. But over the course of 200 years, okay, the universities have basically rejected religion. Religion is not taught. And the reason for that is because they haven't been able to prove the existence of the soul or God scientifically. So what the education system has basically done is they have said that you are practicing a faith, not a science. Okay? And faith can change, and nor is faith verifiable. In other words, you are just believing in statements that are given in a scripture. And you can believe in that or not believe in it. Some people do, some people don't. But there's no way to put it to the test. There's no way to prove any of this. There's no way to prove that, there is an all-powerful creator, you see, like that. presently, our education system is based on material science. Okay? In fact, it's known, presently, our education system is known as being part of the scientific age. You see, modern society is basically a product of the scientific age. You see? So, you see, most religions that are being presented are based on faith, and faith can change, nor is faith verifiable. So, Srila Prabhupada, he wanted the devotees to understand, he wanted us to understand and practice Krishna consciousness as a science. It includes faith, but as a science of self-realization, a science of consciousness. In other words, there's a process by which we can realize the soul and God. You see? That's what's being given here. And even beyond that, there is actually a scientific analysis of creation. The laws that govern creation, like karma. You see? So this subtle science that's being presented as Sankhya is actually meant to bring us to the platform of practicing our spirituality based on faith that's supported by intelligence, that's supported by logic, that's supported by things that we can actually verify and test. But the education system, for the most part, hasn't recognized Srimad Bhagavatam, though it's been presented in a number of ways by the devotees, and now there are more devotees that are entering into the mainstream education system. But pretty much, even up till now, our mainstream education system still sees us as Hindus, and they see us as part of a faith. They don't accept us as practitioners of a science. And there are reasons for that. You see, if you look at the founding fathers, the forefathers, the founders of the scientific age, okay, you basically have three main scientists. You have Galileo, you have Descartes, and you have, oh God, his name's evading me right now. Anyway, let's put Einstein into part of this, okay, because he's so well-respected, all right? So, if you look at these, at the original scientists who are the founders of the scientific age, what they did was they analyzed the material world in terms of 24 elements. Okay? The Sankhya philosophy does the same thing. Okay? But the Sankhya philosophy, it goes beyond just the gross elements, and it deals with subtle elements, and it also deals with spiritual elements. Okay? So it's actually more encompassing. Now, for example, Descartes, he wrote an elaborate philosophy, scientific philosophy, and he divided material energy, which he broke into 24 elements, like earth and water and fire, right? These things. And then he had a 25th element, which he called the mind element. Okay? The term that he used was, I'm thinking of Indriyani here, but it's not a Sanskrit term. It's, anyway, there are two terms that he uses, it's evading me right now. Kojita, that was the name, Kojita. He has two names. The mind element is known as Kojita, and the material elements, there's another name that he has for the material elements. So, Descartes, Galileo, all of them, if you study those original founders, they recognized that there was something different from the material energy. And basically, they defined it in terms of feelings, desires, and intelligence. And they said that these things are different that consciousness is different from matter. They recognize that. Okay? But the problem that they had was, they, even though they presented that, they had no way... Oh, thanks for doing that. They had no way of proving its existence. So what's gone on for the last 200 years since these original founders of the scientific age stated this, many attempts were made to verify the existence of consciousness, but they have failed because they're trying to prove spiritual, you know, elements, spirit consciousness, using material science. Okay? What the Bhagavatam explains is there is material energy, which can be verified with material, you know, sense perception. But there's subtle material energy, which can be verified through a type of yoga, but it's a science, subtle science, that deals with the mind, the intelligence, and the false ego. And it's verifiable through higher levels of consciousness. See, the Bhagavatam, it explains that our consciousness can contract or it can expand. Just like, say, when you're watching television at night, right? So when you turn off the TV, the picture, right, goes down to a little dot and then disappears, right? So in the same way, our consciousness, say when you go to sleep at night, right, you're conscious of things, then gradually, you know, you kind of wind down, and then your consciousness is like that dot, poop, right? So consciousness can expand. So there are four basic levels of consciousness. There is the bodily consciousness, okay? If you look in Sanskrit, the word Atma, for example, which is the term that defines the soul. Now, Atma is divided into, the definition of Atma has three categories. Atma can refer to the body, Atma can refer to the mind, and Atma can refer to the soul, depending on the level of consciousness that we have. Okay? So bodily consciousness, right? It basically means that, you know, I'm an American, I'm a, you know, a 50-year-old man, right? I'm, and I need, right, to eat, I need to sleep, I have, you know, basic bodily demands, right? You see? Like that. Now, the higher level of consciousness is the subtle level, which we're discussing here. Now, bodily consciousness, it is intensified, or it is it captures our consciousness. It dominates us when we allow ourselves to become influenced primarily by the mode of ignorance. The modes of nature are not pure, so they mix. Lord Chaitanya, he describes that there are basically 81 different mixtures of the modes that we go through every day. So it's not that somebody is purely in ignorance. Our consciousness will be mixed with passion and with goodness at every moment. But when we're dominated by ignorance, then we become controlled by the bodily concept of life or by bodily consciousness. If we elevate ourselves, okay, beyond that, then we deal with the mind. So the mind and the body are influenced by the material energy and they generate five basic desires. Okay? For the body, there's eating, there's sleeping, there's sex, and there's defending ourselves. Okay? Defending ourselves generally in modern terms means having a roof over our head, right? Having our bills paid, right? Having our insurance policy and our medical insurance, right? All these things. So for most of us, defense means that. If you're a member of the National Rifle Association, it can mean more than that. You see? So, you've got, right? You've got eating, sleeping, mating, defending. This is common even amongst animals. Okay? That's bodily consciousness. Now, for the mind is pretty much stimulated or propelled by a desire to gain a sense of superiority over others. See? We saw the original Vedic culture, if you look at the history of India, right? It was called Daivivanashra. Okay, so it divides. Krishna himself teaches this in the Gita and in other Vedic scriptures. Our life, human life, is meant to be go through 8 different divisions. Okay? So for our working life, we are meant to be practice brahmacharya, grihastha. This is the spiritual divisions. Spiritual divisions are brahmacharya, grihastha, vanaprastha, and sannyas. So all of us are meant to go through these divisions. 25 years of brahmacharya or brahmacharini life means when we learn how to dedicate ourselves to a spiritual master and to Krishna and how to control the senses. It doesn't mean learning Sanskrit grammar. It can include Sanskrit, it can include Indian music, it can include these things. But the main purpose of brahmacharya is learn how to dedicate oneself to the Supreme Lord, the Guru, and how to control the senses and the mind. That's the goal of the first 25 years of life, according to the Vedic literature. Grihastha means, and a grihastha ashram is generally, it's said to be optional. Prabhupada defined it as every man should remain a brahmachari and every woman should become married. So, but grihastha, see, it's interesting because there are 2 terms in married life. There is grihastha and there is grihamedi. Grihastha is an ashram. Grihastha means when men and women are properly married and they have children and they raise the children in God consciousness. Okay? And they focus, they center their life around serving Krishna. You see? You'll see a lot of married couples here, right? Like Sudhir Krishna Prabhu and his wife, right? They're worshiping the deities and doing so many things together, you know. You see, and with Krishna consciousness in the center of the relationship. All right? So that's meant to be up to the age of 50. You see? Prabhupada recommended that girls get married around 16 and guys get married around 25. You see? And have that kind of distance, you know, a little bit of distance between the age. Prabhupada said between 3 to 10 years of age, there should be separation. The boy should be older than the girl. Right? That kind of relationship works easier. So then in the third division, vanaprastha, the man and woman stay together as a married couple, but they stop engaging in sex and they only focus on their spiritual life. Generally, they'll go to visit temples. They'll be practicing sadhana morning and evening. They'll be more focused on their spiritual development and they stay together. Okay? And they help their children raise their own children. Right? They become grandparents at a certain stage usually in that period. Okay? So because the family that stays together in spiritual life like that becomes much easier. This, what do you call that in India now? Instead of a large family, you have what's known as, I mean, it's worldwide now. What do you call that? There's a term for it where the boy and girl just go away by themselves. A what? No. Not eloping. When you just live, you know, you say you're properly married, but you're not living with your extended family. You're not living with your parents. See, the Vedic tradition, even like me, like my family was, my mother's side of the family is Italian, and my father's side of the family is German. But until a certain stage, like our whole family was together. Like we even lived in the same neighborhood, or, you know, our family was like always together. Like our grandparents were there, our aunts and uncles were there, all of our nephews and nieces, and everybody was together. But now it's like an autonomous type of married life, which just makes it so much harder on everybody. You know, like, for example, my wife's from Singapore. She's South Indian. So they have a large family. Her mother had 8 children. Like, my mom had 5 kids, 6, one was a miscarriage, 5 children. But I've even seen families, Indian families, that had 25 children. But, you know, you cringe at that thought. But see, for them, it was very easy. They had property. They had cows for milk. They had their own garden. They had their own river water. They had their sisters and brothers and aunts and uncles and mom and dad. They had these beautiful home, like their extended family living in. It was almost like I don't want to call it. It's not a castle, but it's a large estate. And they'd have 200 people in their family, you know, in their immediate family. But they loved each other. They take care of each other. Like with my wife's family, for example, between all of us, when we get together, you know, husbands, wives, kids, there's about 40 to 50 people in the family. It's so much fun. You know, my wife's father helped me with my business. When my wife was tired, her sisters would take our kids. You know, I mean, it's just like, it's a lot easier to be part of a team than to just be by yourself. What you'll see in many cases is husband and wife will go off on their own because they can't relate to their parents. And that's due to, because it's not a spiritual relationship. Relationships just based on sense gratification. So, you know, if that's, you know, how you're getting your happiness, you're going to definitely be frustrated. You know, if you look at it in very simple terms, okay? The purpose, once Prabhupada was asked, what's the purpose of life? Prabhupada, 2 intellectuals asked Prabhupada this question in Mexico. What is the purpose of life? And Prabhupada, first of all, he said, first explain to me that life has no purpose. And then I'll explain to you that life has a purpose, what the purpose of life is. So they couldn't say anything. Can you explain that? Right? I mean, it's a challenge, right? To explain to me what the purpose of life is. Right? So Prabhupada said, explain to me first, life has no purpose. Can you do that? That blew their intelligence right out of their heads, right? Because that's impossible. That's insane. So you're living life with no purpose. So then Prabhupada said the purpose of life is ananda, happiness. Right? We can all agree on that, right? Don't you guys want to be happy? Right? Does anybody wake up in the morning and want to be miserable? Do you guys plan it? Like, oh, wait, what was that? Yeah, you know, the mental illness is another topic. But the point I'm making is, see, the word ananda, is a Sanskrit word for happiness, and it means happiness that's always increasing. Okay? Now, when Prabhupada said that, you know, see, the purpose of life is happiness, the purpose of, so the purpose of studying this is how to be happy. Like all the time. Like, and have our happiness increasing. That's what this culture, that's what this science, that's what Krishna consciousness is meant to do. Okay? So, now, if, you know, just bringing this down to a very simple concept that we can deal with, right? Because this can be very, you know, evasive. It can be very, like, ambiguous, it can be very, you know, vague, these concepts. But if we try to bring it down, okay, just very simple ideas. See, if we try to become happy with material things, right, if we just say that my sense enjoyment is the source of my happiness, okay, so if we try to become happy with material things, the point that Krishna is making, that is being made throughout this literature, is that everything material is temporary. So if we try to be happy with something that's temporary, our happiness is also temporary. So when happiness comes to an end, how do you feel? What was that? I work a lot with kids. Kids will say, unhappy, sad. And as you get older, the terms get a little more intense. Krishna, he breaks it down in the Bhagavad Gita. He gives a verse, Akama Esha Krodha Esha Rajaguna Samadbhava. He says that you will become frustrated. You will become angry. You will be depressed, disillusioned, and bewildered. So that's pretty much the product of the bodily concept of life. Everything that we do, that's where we're trying to acquire happiness from sense objects, will always end in misery. You gotta just accept it. I know it's like impossible to accept that, especially the way we're fueled by corporate psychology and the way, you know, everything is meant to, like, you know, just like enjoy, right? But it's a mirage in a desert. It's like bait for a mouse, you know, in a trap. It just ends in misery again and again and again and again and again. You see? And life becomes like riding these waves of an ocean of emotion, you know. Like sometimes you're up high and sometimes you're down low. And what's happening nowadays is most people are down low all the time. They're not even going up anymore. So, you see, the point that's being made in the science is that happiness that comes from our spiritual development, okay, is not limited by the temporal nature of this material world. That is ananda. But most people that study this become confused with this point. They become confused with this point. And what they'll do, if you look in India, what you'll see, because India, this is your tradition. You have the history, right? We're the newcomers here. So, but if you look in India, you'll see many sadhus giving up everything and just going and living in a forest or in a cave, you know, like that. Even my guru, Maharaj Tamal Krishna Goswami, when he took sannyas, sometimes he would go to wealthy business people in India to get donations for Prabhupada, for preaching, and women wouldn't let him go and see their husbands because they were afraid. They're afraid that if my husband hears too much from this sadhu, he'll leave my home. He'll give the money that I want, you know, for my needs or for my children, right? He'll give it away to Krishna. And how will I be happy? What will be my benefit? You see? But does Krishna send Arjuna away to the forest in the Gita? No. Krishna doesn't tell Arjuna just to chant japa. He tells Arjuna, take over the whole world. Arjuna even asked that question, why should I fight with my family? Better I go to the forest. Krishna says, if you go to the forest, you're going to be the same person. You think you're going to be any happier there? You think your nature is going to change? The forest is more, it's dominated by the mode of goodness. So there are benefits to living a simpler life, a more natural lifestyle. But the point that Krishna makes to Arjuna is that beyond just living in the mode of goodness, we need to get free from these modes of nature, ignorance, passion, and goodness, and we need to return to the spiritual world. The example Prabhupada gives is of living in a being in prison, right? So being in prison, Prabhupada, he breaks it into three categories. You heard this example, right? So you have like Class C, Class B, Class A prison. So Class C prison, they just have you sleep on the concrete. You're in solitary confinement. Nobody can see you. There's no lights. You don't come out. They just give you dry bread to eat, right? You can't see your family. You don't talk to anybody. You don't go outside. Okay? But if you're really good, you can go to Class B. So Class B prison, there's no heating and air conditioning. Right? In Class B prison, you've got, they give you a little mat to sleep on. They give you some tomatoes and lettuce with your dry bread. There's still no heating and air conditioning. And, you're living in an environment where you're always afraid. Like, you could be killed at any moment by any crazy person. Right? And they let you go outside once a week and play volleyball inside the barbed wire. But if you're really good, you can move to Class A prison. Class A prison, you get a better mattress, you get an LED screen in your room, you can go online 45 minutes a day, you can see your family once a week. Right? So if you're really intelligent, where do you want to go? A prison. No, but if you're really intelligent, what do you want? You want to get out of prison. Exactly. So the point that Krishna is making in the Gita is, Arjuna, don't live in the mode of ignorance like Class C, right? Like an animal. Don't live in Class B. Don't live in Class A, even in goodness. Get out of prison, Arjuna. Get out of the material world. You got it? Clear, right? See, because most of us, we're worshiping Krishna. Krishna, please, Class A. What? Get out of prison, but Krishna. Class A looks so good to me right now. You see? But to do that, is that easy? No. We're talking about the most difficult thing that we'll ever do in our lives. To get free from the bodily concept, to get free from the dictations of the mind, the desire to be superior to others, to get free from even the mode of goodness, you gain this sense of happiness and you gain this sense of superiority. I'm better, I'm sinless, I'm this and that. It's very hard to get free from this, the influence of the material energy. This is much more difficult than becoming even a millionaire or something like that. You know why is the temple is not very popular? Right? We got how many people in Dallas-Fort Worth? 7 million people. Look at us. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 of us here. Right? Out of 7 million. The reason this is not popular, even amongst Indians, is because we cannot be the center of attention, and Krishna is the center. People don't like that. I want to be the center of everything. I want all the affection. I want all the recognition. I want all the enjoyment. Okay, I'm a devotee. Let me give as little as I can to Krishna just to prove to myself that I'm a devotee. Right? Prabhupada gives the example, he calls it Govinda Namaha. Like, see, in India they make puff rice, right? You guys have all had puff rice. So the traditional way of making puff rice, I don't know if you've ever done this, Geetika, but they have a big wok with sand in it, okay? And they put the rice, regular rice, into the sand, and it's on a fire, right? So as you turn the sand, as the sand gets hot, the rice puffs like popcorn, okay? So then to get the sand out of the rice, what they'll do is they have a type of basket. It's like kind of squarish. It's got a scoop. It's like a shovel almost. It's kind of, it's like about this wide on one side, and then it comes down to a thin edge. And they can scoop it under the sand with the puff rice in there, and then they throw it up in the air, okay? And then the sand falls quicker than the rice because the rice is light, right? So when you become expert at it, right, they scoop it, they throw it, they move the basket, their sand falls, they put the basket, they catch all the puff rice, and then they put the rice in a pot, right? But some of the rice blows away from the wind. Some of the puff rice blows away from the wind. So when that little bit of rice blows away, they say, Govinda Namaha. Govinda, I'm offering this to you. And most of us, see, because we are so conditioned to putting ourselves in the center of everything, we are doing that in our Krishna consciousness. And so our love for Krishna is kind of like stunted. And that's why it's not so popular. People think, oh, better I worship Ganesh. Why should I worship Krishna? Ganesh will give me so much gold. Why do you want the gold? Sense gratification? I have some friends, they're super rich. You go to their house, they've got 7 refrigerators, guys. 7 refrigerators. Can you imagine going out with your husband, right? Honey, we need to buy us a new refrigerator. But honey, we've got 6 already, but I need a 7th one. Come on. All right, I'll do whatever you want. Let's go get a 7th refrigerator for our home today. You know, I mean, it becomes like weird at a certain point, right? And especially if you think about it in terms of Class C, Class B, Class A, and getting out of prison, you know, at a certain point, it's like simplifying our lives. You know, is really the smartest thing to do. It's not about acquiring more and more and more things. At a certain point, you know, it's like, honey, can we celebrate Christmas this year by saving money? My wife told me that, you know, a couple of years ago. We went out shopping, and I said, come on, is there something you want? She said, look, I got everything, you know. She said, look, I just want to celebrate Christmas by saving money this year. Okay, so, you know, drawing us back into the scientific analysis here, you see, when you look at the history, right, in India, you'll see the original Vanashram system, okay? So you had the Brahmacharyas, Grihasthas, Vanaprastha, and then Sannyas. Sannyas means that a man at the final 25 years of his life, so we're breaking life into 100 years, we're analyzing life in terms of 100 years, we're breaking it into 25-year intervals. 25 years learning how to control your senses and mind and dedicate your life to Krishna. 25 years, husband and wife are together, raise a family, make as much money as possible. 25 years, husband and wife help their kids raise their own kids and spend their time freeing themselves and helping and supporting one another in Krishna consciousness. And then 25 years where the man and woman completely separate themselves and the man dedicates himself fully, like Prabhupada did, to spreading spiritual life and teaching others. And the woman is taken care of by her elder children, older sons, generally, like that. So everybody's good, you see? If a man takes sannyas, it says that 7 generations of his family before him and 7 generations of his family after him will all go back to Godhead. You know? Now, because we only got a couple minutes, I want to give one example. Prabhupada gives this example in India, like in Vrindavan. A lot of times you'll see men will come to Vrindavan, you know, to practice like sannyas, right? So say throughout their life, they've raised like, let's say, 3 crores of rupees. A crore of rupees is 10 million rupees, okay? I mean, that's a lot of money. Let's just throw it out like they're millionaires, right? Okay. So now he gives 3 crores, you know, he gives like 2 crores to his wife. He gives 1 crore to his son. You know, he gave 1 crore to his daughter when she got married, right? And he says, look at my dear wife, I'm going to go live in Vrindavan now, but every month you give me 200 rupees to worship Krishna. Now, love is based on selfless service. The more selflessly we serve Krishna, the more Krishna reveals himself to us. It's like that for everybody. If you love somebody, if the person is very affectionate, like, you know, real love means that at a certain point, the person that you love becomes more dear to you than your own life and soul. That's love. Right? You see like famous kings and famous people, you know, where they love each other so intensely, you know. It's just amazing when you hear these things. So Krishna is saying that, Sarvadharman Parityaja, please, you know, just try to love me, you know, with your heart and soul. That's what Krishna is saying. And because that's what attracts me, that's what attracts all of us. Right? Like if somebody really loves you, calls you on your phone, right? What do? Like, oh, yeah. Thanks for calling me. Like, you know, you're living your whole day for that phone call, you know? If somebody does it that you don't love calls you, what do you guys do? Let it ring a few more times. So Krishna's the same way, see? We can analyze our own consciousness and understand what God is, you know, what God is like, you know. We're part and parcel of Krishna. So Krishna is asking that, you know, he's saying, come on, guys, you know. Now, Krishna, he's loving us all the way, every day. Like, you know, he's providing the sun, the air, the everything that we use, you know, the ability to see, to speak, to think, you know, like every feeling, every emotion. These things are not being created by, you know, IBM. You know, and Krishna gives all of it to us for free. Right? You don't go out there and look up at the sun and see a little price tag up there. Krishna is providing everything, and Krishna is like totally loving us. And all Krishna is saying is, hey, you guys, come on. You know, like, I got this whole spiritual world, and you're more dear to me than my own life and soul. And I'm not going to interfere with your independence because there wouldn't be any love if I did that. But, you know, come on, guys. Like, you know, there's really something cool happening over here in the spiritual world, and you're supposed to be part of it. Like, what's the delay, man? Like, you know, have you ever like gone to a party or something, right? And you got a friend that's like just dragging themselves, and it's like you're calling them, you know, you're sending them like the 911 messages, you know, like, come on, man, the concert's starting. Like, where are you? You know, that's what Krishna is saying in this. So then the point that I want to finish with here is that, you know, so this man, right, he gives millions of dollars to his family, and he goes to Vrindavan, and he asks his wife, give me 200 rupees to worship Krishna with. So if you give Krishna 200 rupees, and I'm not saying you don't take care of your wife and your family, but you're giving your family 3 crores of rupees, then Krishna's only going to reveal himself 200 rupees. Right? Krishna's not like a dunce. Like, if we're keeping, like, everything for ourselves and we're just giving, like, you know, here as little as I can to you, right? Then Krishna's only going to reveal himself a little bit. But if we start to, you know, like, Bhaktivinoda Thakur said that spiritual life is a series of progressive adjustments. So we need to look carefully, you know, like evaluate, like our time, our money, our relationships, you know, our heart. And try to, you know, like, just bring out the goodness in our own hearts, you know. And we're never the loser like that. Krishna, you know, he's ready to give himself to us. You see, now that is really something, you know. And all it's, and the point that I was saying about the people become confused when they hear this, because, you know, they're thinking that Krishna is saying, I don't want you guys to be happy materially. I don't want you to be successful materially. Krishna's not saying that at all. In fact, Krishna's telling Arjuna, I want you to be so successful, I want you to rule the whole world. Arjuna was the one who had the brakes on. Arjuna was the one, well, I don't know if I want to do it, you know. And Krishna was telling him, I want you to you know, use your full potential. And it was Arjuna who was like hesitating. He was the one who wanted to leave. You see? Sometimes it looks like devotees are being selfish, right? Like, oh my God, you know, look at the house, look at the car, look at the, you know. But Krishna, he actually loves to see the devotees taken care of. It's not, but the difference is one person is taking care of themselves in a selfish way. The other person is doing it to please Krishna. You guys follow that? It's pretty natural, but it's an active, it's an act of love. You know? Usually women are like totally natural, you know, at being very loving. I mean, it's, come on. And that women are like the gurus for the whole world. Like, you know, I mean, we learn everything from our mothers. We might learn everything from our wives too. I know I learned a lot. I think marriage is really important. You know, to develop that loving nature. Okay, so, yeah, I mean, this is a big topic. I mean, we're talking like, this is like PhD stuff, you know, like discussing all this subtle energy. But the thing we should really understand is that our whole society, man, they don't understand even the simplest points that are being brought out here. Are leading people, and they don't understand the law of karma, they don't understand that there's life after death, they don't understand how their actions in this life are going to affect their life in the next life. People are thinking, well, I'm an American, you know, I'm kind of attractive, and, you know, I've got a nice car, so I'm good, right? But in the next life, and, you know, we could be really in a bad situation unless we wake up to this. So like all of us, you know, that's a real act of love. If you want to show love, and it's the most loving thing you can do for Krishna, is try to help other people understand, you know. Yeah, so we'll stop here. Yeah, thanks. Prabhupada gives the example, yeah. Gopal's question is, you know, how do you pick the people you spend the time with? Prabhupada gives the example of a medic going into a battlefield. So, I don't know, I'm into like martial arts and stuff, so sometimes I watch these military shows and things like that, you know. It's always, and it's also reminds me of Krishna and like Mahabharata a lot, because yeah, it's always like evil against good. I mean, that's what wars are, right? So, Prabhupada gives the example of a medic going into a battlefield. So, you know, some soldiers are very badly wounded, and some aren't so wounded. So who does the medic go to first? The worst off. You all think the worst off? No, Prabhupada said you go to the least wounded first. Because the least wounded soldiers, you know, you're going to help your own soldiers, right? So you want it, the least wounded can actually recover and help fight. So the medics go to the least wounded first and try to revive them and arrange for their, you know, recovery. You see? So that's what Prabhupada said when you actually go out. But Lord Chaitanya's mercy was for everyone. So, you know, in certain circumstances, like we know we do Harinam, you're very good at that. You know, it's not like, or we go and distribute prasadam. You know, I mean, it's funny, you know, when you look at relief agencies, right, they always talk about feeding the poor, feeding the needy. What about the rich people? You know, like, everybody needs Krishna's mercy. You know, I mean, we're distributing prasadam. The rich guy might need the mercy more than the poor guy. I mean, that's what most scriptures say, right? Like, it's more difficult for a rich man to go to the kingdom of God than to thread a camel through the eye of a needle. Poor people are usually, you know, like, man, I really need the mercy. Like, I mean, I need something here because I am down. They're more receptive, usually, poor people. So, you know, in certain circumstances, we're not discriminating. But when it comes down to, like, what you said, you know, spending your time, like I used to see my Guru Maharaj, like in a lecture, you can see when people are interested in you because they're looking at you, right? I mean, if somebody's sitting there looking at their phone or, you know, talking and stuff, you know, they're... But if somebody's like right on you, you know, like when you're distributing books, that's a technique in book distribution. People are walking by, but if somebody looks at you, right, and they're like focusing on you, you stop that person because you can see they're interested in you. Give them the book. So those are some simple points, but, you know. Oh, no, no, no. Like, when it comes to like intimate family relationships, you know, and things, personally, my experience has been that your actions speak much more powerfully than your words. So if you're like, you know, the most lovable son, a great brother, you know, a friend. No, but I'm talking about, I mean, that's what, you know, it's all about, man. When, you know, if you're showing some genuine love to people, you know, those are the people who are going to ask, man, what are you all about, man? You are like the best friend I've ever had, you know, like... You know, that's preaching. It's not about us trying to, like, force, you know, our religion on somebody. Or, you know, really, our worship of Radha and Krishna is our intimate affair. And when we go out in public, pretty much I would say that we should be addressing topics like, you know, Darwin's theory. Things that, you know, are like more core to the materialistic education system. Just like when I started talking about Descartes, right? See, the problem that happened with Descartes is he couldn't prove the existence of the soul. So Descartes, he couldn't prove the existence of the soul. So someone might ask, well, why not? You know, because like if you... Like, for example, science today, okay, science today, nobody's doing all those experiments. Man, everybody is just accepting 99% on hearsay. And it's not even from the person that's done the experiment. We're hearing from a person that learned from somebody, to somebody else, to somebody else, to somebody else. You could spend your whole life trying to do these experiments, like, proving the existence of, you know, the helium, you know, molecule or whatever, you know. I mean, and the stuff is insanely expensive, the laboratories and the preciseness. Like, I remember there was one student, and he was trying to verify the electric charge on a molecule. I don't know if you guys have ever heard about this stuff. But, I mean, it's really boring. But, you know... To do it is so many factors. And even in his laboratory, the cars would go by on the road and would screw the whole thing up. The guy had to do the experiment at like midnight just to be able to do it because there were so many factors in the experiment. one experiment, man. And this guy is doing this thing, you know, for how many years he's doing research to come up to this point. So what's going on in the name of science today, you know, is really like hearsay. But the thing that I'm saying about Descartes was those guys, Descartes, Galileo, others, they recognized that consciousness was different from the material energy, but they couldn't prove it. So someone might say, well, you know, when you ask a scientist today, well, they say, we're going to prove it in the future, right? You know, we just haven't gotten there yet. But the problem with Descartes was, you know, normally when you talk about somebody proving something scientific, they have a procedure. You know, like, okay, you're going to prove, say, for example, the function of a cell with chemistry. You know, so you go into a laboratory, right? What do? You put on your laboratory jacket, right? And, you know, you've got beakers and, you know, and you start pouring acid over cells and breaking them down and then analyzing, you know, the components of the cell, you know, with a electromagnetic microscope. You know, they had a procedure. But what I'm saying is Descartes, those guys didn't have a procedure. There was nothing, they didn't know, you know, there wasn't anything in place for them. So, over 200 years went by and people just speculated and tried to figure it out, like, you know, they do this introspective analysis of Descartes' concept of cogita, the existence of consciousness, you know, but they all always tried to do it with material science and it failed. So after 200 years, all these guys in these educational fields have all said consciousness doesn't exist. There's no way to verify it. There's no way to prove it. There's no way to prove the existence of God. There's no way to prove consciousness. And they've written these elaborate things like, you know, if you look at like the Big Bang Theory or Darwin's Theory, there's no discussion of consciousness there. But the simplest fact of our daily life is we're conscious. So anyway, I don't want to talk you guys' ears off, but that's what you're dealing with. So for us, you know, to come up just a little bit, you know, to the point where we can actually prove, at least we should be able to present this in a way that these guys can't rip it apart in front of everybody. Okay? Because we're never going to convince these hardcore atheistic scientists. These guys are bent, and that's how they make their money. Yeah. You just prove that guy's going to lose his job. He's going to lose his house in Beverly Hills. His wife's going to walk out on him. He won't be able to afford his kids in college, right? You think the guy's going to agree to Hare Krishna? So, but the point that I'm making is there's a lot of people that are on the fence, right? There's a lot of people that could go either way. So at least when we go out in public, we should be able to present this in such a way that they can't rip it apart. You see? So that's our job. Our job is to develop ourselves to the point where at least we can make a presentation on behalf of Krishna. Like, we may not be very great, but we are representing the greatest of the great. So, I'm going to stop there. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. I hope you have a wonderful day. It was a lot of fun having you here, too. Okay, Hare Krishna. Sorry, I'm not working on the road now, but I love to give class. Thanks for the encouragement.